This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you from the Orpheum Theater in Wichita, Kansas. Yes. Now, Kansas was a different world 85 million years ago. For starters, most of it was underwater. The whole continent was split apart by a shallow sea that stretched from the Gulf of Mexico to the Arctic Ocean, from the Rockies to the Appalachians. And it was full of sea monsters. Sharks and giant fish and reptiles 15 meters long swam the sea while pteranodons flew overhead, plus 6-foot-long marine birds that still had teeth. How do we know any of this? When the waters retreated, their remains, the bones, the teeth, and even the stomach contents occasionally stayed put, stuck in these soft, chalky shales of western Kansas. In fact, some of the most spectacular fossil finds in North America have come from this state. Here on stage with me to talk about all the wonders under the Kansas Sea, please welcome Laura Wilson, Associate Professor of Geosciences at Fort Hays State University, Chief Curator of the Sternberg Museum of Natural History in Fort Hays. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Mike Everhart, Adjunct Curator of Paleontology at the Sternberg Museum in Fort Hays and author of Oceans of Kansas, A Natural History of the Western Interior Sea. Welcome. Thank you for coming with us. Laura, can you give us an idea how big the sea was?
So from north-south, it stretched from the Arctic Ocean to what's the Caribbean Sea now. And then east-west, you have to imagine a United States or North America without the Rocky Mountains. So went over to into Utah and then would stretch into the eastern part of Kansas and into Missouri, where the eastern shoreline was.
And Mike, how did we first discover that Kansas was underwater so many eons ago?
Well, actually, the discovery happened during the 1860s and 1870s, more than 100 years ago, and people started finding fossils as the railroad and the settlements took place in western Kansas.
And so, Laura, tell us what lived in the ocean. Describe some of these animals that were there.
So it's a really very different assemblage in some ways to what we think about with ocean ecosystems today. So you still have fish of all sizes, big teeth, those that are crushing shells, but there are no marine mammals. So when we think of dolphins and whales and seals and sea lions, none of those have evolved yet. So those niches were filled by big marine reptiles. So we have mosasaurs and plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs. So big lizards, essentially, with big teeth and long tails that would be the top predators. We also had some seabirds like we have today, but these are a lot more similar to their dinosaurian ancestors than the ones we might see flying around. And then also we had the pterosaurs, so the big flying reptiles. They're not birds, they're not dinosaurs, but they're filling a lot of those aerial niches in the ecosystems.
Are there any modern survivors still around of those of that era?
No, none of the animals that we're really interested in today out there have direct descendants. The marine lizards, the mosasaurs, and so on were related to modern snakes and monitor lizards, Komodo dragon type stuff, but they are not descendants. So, and of course, the pteranodons are all gone. Most of the fish species, of course, are many lineages of fish are around today, but most of the ones that we collect or see out in the chalk went extinct about the same time as the dinosaurs.
So even though they look like dinosaurs, they have this sore name in them, they were not dinosaurs.
Correct.
Well, can you explain that a little?
So in a lot of different ways, when we look at, when we call something a descendant, you know, if we put it on a family comparison, it implies a parent, child, or a direct offspring. So these things, these animals would have shared a common ancestor at some point, how you share a grandparent with your cousin, but you're not a descendant of your cousin. So they share relatives or a common ancestor with a lot of things that are around today. but it's not a descendant, an offspring descendant relationship.
Let's go to the questions in the audience. Yes, sir.
Hi. First off, Ira, I would like to thank you on behalf of the Kansas Association of Teachers of Science. We call ourselves CATS.
You're welcome. Thank you for. You're welcome.
So my question is, you know, as children, we learn that there are millions and millions of dinosaurs and underwater reptiles, and it makes sense with sharks because, you know, you go into any museum, you can buy shark teeth for, you know, like a dollar. But how do we, like, there's not millions of mosasaur skulls, so why do we think that there were so many of them back then?
Why were they common? Why do we think they were common?
Because, for one thing, they're found all over the world. Every continent, including Antarctica, that has rock deposits of this age includes mosasaurs. Mosasaurs came along late. They were after plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs had been around during the Mesozoic for 100 million years. And then these upstart mosasaurs come, most probably evolved here in North America, but suddenly entered the water. And within 10 to 15 million years, they spread completely around the world. You have to remember that the planet Earth during the late Cretaceous was a very warm water world. It was about 85% covered with water. There were no ice caps, there were no glaciers, no real winter. So it was the marine animals that basically ran the Earth. The dinosaurs were all kind of limited to 15% of the mass. These guys were everywhere, and they grew bigger and bigger, and they evolved in all kinds of different forms. So to me, these were the stars in terms of the creatures that we dig up out of the rocks from the age of dinosaurs.
We can also look to modern ecosystems to some degree as well when we talk about things like carrying capacity, how many apex predators versus the prey items. And so that alone can give us an idea of what sort of diversity we would expect to find. And looking at, you know, less than 1% of living organisms become fossilized, that when we do find fossils, we can kind of extrapolate a little bit off of that about how many we're not finding just due to different physical and chemical factors.
Where do you find them, Laura? I'll ask both of you, Laura and Mike. Where do you go hunting for them, or do you dig them up?
Well, Mike and I, mostly here in Kansas, spend our time in western Kansas, where, you know, when it comes to finding fossils, it's finding the right age rock of the right environment at the surface of the earth at the right time. And so right now in western Kansas are the chalks and the shales that have these fantastic creatures in them. And so we can go out, and it's pretty low tech. You walk around and look at the ground until you find something.
And that's really a good description of the process. We've got the Badlands in western Kansas out along the Smoky Hill and the Saline and Solomon Rivers, and it's just literally square miles of exposed chalk that you walk across, and hopefully you find teeth or you find a bone coming out, and that'll lead you to a larger specimen. But it's a lot of just walking and looking.
Let's go down to the audience here. Yes.
What happened to all the water?
What happened to all the water? That's a great question.
A very good question, because another thing people don't understand about Kansas is that we've been underwater for 500 million years, if you will, half a billion years. The rocks, all of the mineral resources in this state are sea bottom. We're here in Wichita, we're sitting on about a mile of rock that is all sediments from various seas that have listed here in the past. But with continental plate movement around this planet, things come together and collide, and about 200 million years ago, there was a massive collision on the western coast of North America that pushed up the center of North America, and eventually, at the end of the Cretaceous, 66 million years ago, pushed Kansas above sea level for the last time. And so that's why we're sitting up here now at about 1,200 foot above the ocean, and we'll never be an ocean again. But prior to then, we had pretty much always been underwater.
Well, I have one final question for you, and that I'm sure we have inspired a lot of amateur fossil hunters now, right? What do we do if we dig up some fossils? What's the best thing to do with them instead of putting them in your drawer and forgetting about them?
Well, if you find something that's big enough that you have to dig it up, don't do it. Please contact someone who can help you do it right. Fossils are fragile. They've been in the ground for 85 million years in the case of mosasaurs. But once you start taking them out of the ground, they break down and are into pieces that are useless. Collecting shark's teeth or scraps of this, that, and the other, that's great. But if you happen to come across something that is large and you want to, you know, get it out of the ground, get some help. There's plenty of people at museums that would be glad to give you advice, go out and meet you in the field, whatever, and do it right.
Well, this has been fascinating. Thank you both for taking time to
Thanks
be with us today.
Us.
Mike Everhart, adjunct curator of paleontology at the Sternberg Museum, author of Oceans of Kansas, Natural History of the Western Interior Sea, and Laura Wilson, associate professor of geosciences at Fort Hays State University, chief curator at the Sternberg Museum of Natural History in Fort Hays. Thank you. Thank you both again.
Thank you.
And throughout the show, we have a special treat for you, some musical entertainment. Ladies and gentlemen, Shane Marler and Nikki Mottlemark. Come on up. After the break, we'll talk about the cleanup crews of the natural world, dung beetles and carrion beetles, and the researchers who love them. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto, coming to you from the Orpheum Theater in Wichita, Kansas. Yes. And as a reward for all of you who have stayed and watched the program, we now have a special for you. We're going to talk about recycling. As you know, it's very much a part of daily life these days. You got your bins for paper, for glass, for plastic. But we humans weren't the first. No, we didn't come up first. First ones with the idea. Nature has had its own recycling system for eons. And hey, maybe you never pondered this. I know I didn't before I got to Kansas. Like, you know, where do you think cow patties go after they come out of a cow? We city slickers didn't think about that very much. You know, you think they just sit there and disintegrate in the sun? Well, it turns out that nature has a sophisticated cleanup crew. Insect workers like dung beetles and carrion beetles that make dead animals and dung and all sorts of decaying stuff disappear and return back to the soil so other living things can use them. So after you hear about the dirty work they do, you might have a little more appreciation for these tiny recyclers. I know my next guests do. You might even say they have Beetlemania. Oh. Okay, I deserve that one. Rachel Stone is a graduate researcher in the Biodiversity Lab at Wichita State University. And so is Emmy Engaster. She's also a graduate researcher at the Biodiversity Lab at Wichita State. Welcome both to Science Friday. Rachel, let's start off with the object of your heart's desire,
yes.
Dung beetles. Oh, yes, clasping your heart. What do you find so special about them?
You know, dung beetles have captivated humans for as long as we've been around. You can think about early Egyptians and how they revered this god, the Kepler god, that carried the sun across the sky. You see the scarab beetle represented in films all the time, like its unfair villainization in the Mummy movie, if you guys recall that. It was also the beetle that got Charles Darwin to start to ponder that idea of sexual selection, for example. And these are really, really important, cool beetles. So I, like many others, fell in love with them.
Well, they actually perform a great service.
They sure do. Right? They're unsung heroes of all ecosystems. They really are.
Well, we're singing about them today, and I think...
Yeah.
Lest people think insects are of a lesser intelligence, is it true, isn't it, that dung beetles can even navigate by the Milky Way?
They sure do. There have been studies where scientists put, if you can imagine, adorable little hats that covered their eyes, they could no longer navigate, and they would wander in circles. But whenever those are removed, they can go in a straight path using the sun and using the Milky Way at night.
Wow, wow. And that, not to be outdone, Emmy, I understand that you're more interested in what shows up for dinner when an animal dies.
Exactly, yes.
The carrion crew. Tell us about your interest in that.
So the carrion beetles are also very interesting because they eat really disgusting stuff. And they show up to these dead carcasses really early, even like seconds or hours after these animals die, and they are there to feed and make babies. And so it's very interesting because if we didn't have them, we would have a lot of dead animals just littering the earth. So they're very important in decomposing.
I hate it when that happens.
Same with dung, too. We don't want to be stepping in that stuff.
Is there a progression of the insects when an animal dies?
Yes, definitely. Flies probably are the first ones to get there, but the carrion beetles want to get there first, too. And there's this whole slew of insects that are there at all different times during the decomposing stages.
Yeah, and in case you're all wondering about how excited people can get about dung beetles, let me take you along on a bug hunting field trip with Emmy, Rachel, and one of our graduate advisors, Mary Liz Jamison, one of your graduate advisors.
So the creek is over here, and then there's these buckets, which we have baited with various yummy selections. This is Lupu, canine poo. And then after that is gizzards for Emmy's stuff. And then the far one is human carnivore poo. So carnivores and herbivores bring in most situations, different kinds of dung beetles.
What'd my girl bring in?
Let's look at it.
Okay.
I want to see.
Let's do it.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Do you want me to go get the forceps?
It's okay, I'll get my fingers gross.
You got one. Oh, hi. That's not who I thought it was.
Yeah, it's geotrippies.
Yeah.
It's an Eleodes.
Oh, stink beetles. They'll put their butt in the air and stink on you so you won't eat them.
Kind of fruity and unusual.
But they are really neat when you start to look at stuff. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why prairies aren't conserved, because people don't sit on the ground and look closely at stuff. But when you do, all of a sudden there's, you know, whole worlds that open up in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that was some heck of a field trip.
Yeah.
I detected the phrase human carnivore poo. Is that what I think it is?
Well, yeah, we have to separate the human carnivore from the human herbivore, the vegetarians of the world. We're all bait producers for beetles.
So these are equal opportunity beetles.
Absolutely.
Some like carnivore poo, some like vegan poo?
You know, we've never tried that in the lab, but we should look into it.
Now, I understand that on your way back from the field the other day, you came across an interesting specimen on the side of the road.
We sure did.
And instead of driving by and averting your eyes like most people would do, you stopped the car and you went to investigate What were you looking for?
We were looking for sylphids, the carrion beetles. Yeah. And we were met with many writhing maggots instead.
Yes.
So, but we believe that this carcass was a little bit too far gone for the carrion beetles to be there. It had been mostly eaten by the maggots. And
wow.
It was amazing to see.
They were so thick under the deer that you could hold your hand up and feel heat coming off of this writhing mat. It was cool.
It was really cool.
I guess it's cool depending on whether you've had dinner yet or not. You know, I've seen some dung beetles with little spikes on their head. Why is that? Is it just a decoration or something?
That's a beautiful example of one right there. This is a male Phanaeus vindex. They're gorgeous beetles. But you'll see these incredible horn structures that will actually vary within a single species on all the males. So you'll have tiny little nubs of a horn, just little suggestions, and then huge, long horns like you see here.
It almost looks like a rhinoceros.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But those horns serve a purpose for this specific group. These guys exhibit a behavior where they tunnel under a dung pat, and you'll see different kind of behaviors with different kind of dung beetles. So, you know, the famous ball rolling that dung beetles do, that's a separate group. But these guys will tunnel down, and those horns serve as this kind of big obstacle, and they protect their tunnel, and they'll block others from passing through to get to the dung resource.
How deep do they tunnel?
It depends on the species. Some can go quite deep. There's huge dung beetles in Africa that can dig tunnels. Some are documented as deep as 8 feet underground, and others you can just kind of dig out with your finger and get them out a couple of inches.
Well, Emmy, let's continue our battle of the beetles here. How how fast can carrion beetles scout out a corpse, and how do they know it's there?
So, as you know, insects have antennae, and these carrion beetles have these clubbed antennae, and what they can pick up chemical senses in the air, odors, and so they use those chemoreceptors on those clubbed antennae to find the carrion, and some of them choose to bury those carcasses, like the burying beetles, and then some of them also will just hang out on the carcasses, eat a little bit here and there, and then they'll lay eggs underneath the carcass, and their babies will just stay there and eat on those carcasses.
Wow.
Yeah.
I just touched on this briefly, Rachel, but I want to get my hands a little dirtier, so to speak, in this. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of animals. Different things that are dying, different things that are pooping.
Mm-hmm.
Are there specialized beetles for all these different?
There absolutely are. There's dung beetles that have a really broad palate. You know, they'll eat any kind of dung they can
find.
That's
an interesting way of phrasing it.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's others that are more persnickety. for example, there are dung beetles that eat only the dung from sloths.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's specialized.
It's very specialized.
Wow. Let's see. I'm sure we have a question or two in the audience about this. So let me go right here.
Hi. I'm wondering if there's a special quality that these bugs have that enables them to not get sick when they eat this stuff. And if so, could we take that and give it to my kids when they don't wash after they go to the bathroom?
Yeah, so carrion beetles do definitely have bacteria in their gut flora, and so I would imagine that they are completely adapted to eating these dead animals, and they don't get sick from eating them. It would be really interesting to look at applications for, you know, helping upset stomachs. But as far as I know, there haven't been any cures for upset stomachs from carrion beetles.
You know, as a show, we always talk about the microbiome a lot. So we're really sensitive to bacteria a lot. And I noticed in this field trip that you took, no one was wearing any gloves going in. So you just go right in. So there must be E. coli all over those beetles, right? And you're going right in there.
Yep, absolutely.
No fear.
We'll start off with
you go home with you, wash your hands at least when you get home.
Yeah, we've got Purell in the car.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the beetles themselves. Do they make their own dung? And do other beetles go after their dung?
I don't know of any beetles that go after dung beetle dung. That would be fascinating. But as of now, I know of none. Those get decomposed by fungi and microbes in the environment. So those are the guys breaking down that kind of poo.
That's great. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Okay, let's go to a question here. Yes, someone at the mic.
How far away from a carcass can they still detect it?
Carrion beetles can detect up to 1 to 2 miles away. They can smell the rotting carcasses, so it's actually really far.
So if they're upwind, it goes with the wind then.
Yeah, and they're flying right to it. I know the American burying beetle can fly almost 1 kilometer in a night. So they're actively searching for that carrion, those dead animals.
Do they signal each other, hey, there's a meal? Like bees talk to one another?
I don't think so, because that would be more competition, because they have to fight over that resource, because it's a very limited resource to find those dead animals, those decaying tissues. So they don't want to attract other beetles except for maybe a female, but they don't want other males showing up.
Let's go to a question right here.
I've seen many pictures of beetles rolling their dung. Why do they roll it that way?
Well, what they're doing is they're going to this, you know, this pile of poop is suddenly plopped on the ground, and you have to imagine it like it's this incredible resource. It's like you're in the desert and there's no food at all, and somebody drops this tray of cheeseburgers on the ground. And everybody's rushing all at once, and they're greedy. They want their fair share of this really limited resource. And so this is just one strategy that dung beetles show, but what he's doing is he's trying to tear a hunk off for himself and take it away from all the chaos of that pile of cheeseburgers or poo. And he's taking it away so he can have it himself.
When we spray our crops with insecticides, are we killing the dung beetles?
We are. Also, when we're treating livestock with things like ivermectin, that kills intestinal parasites, which is a good thing. It also has effects on the insect community within the environment. So primarily dung beetles are hurt by that. And then you have the problem of these cows at that are feeding, and they're pooping everywhere, and then there's no dung beetles there anymore to eat that poo and deal with it. And then you have flies come in, and flies, of course, cause human or vector human disease, so it's a whole other issue to worry about. Causes a lot of problems.
Wow. You know, think about that. Let me see if I can get one or two more questions. Yes, right here.
I'm asking this for my brother, so this is a question for both of you. Why are the beetles so brightly colored?
So
that's a great question.
For the carrion beetles, they a lot of times have these orange or yellow patches on them, and that's warning coloration, because what they want to do is deter predators from eating them because they stink like rotting flesh. And so they're trying to get those predators to not eat them. Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned that one beetle that the field trip we heard, it turns its backside up, and what happens?
It'll musk you.
Yep.
It lets out a foul stench so that you don't want to mess with it.
It's not so bad.
Well, yeah, not to us. We're used to it by now.
I can't think of a better way to end this segment with that. Can't top that comment. Thank you both, Rachel Stone and Emmy and Gasser. Both graduate researchers at the Biodiversity Lab at Wichita State University. Thanks again for highlighting your work for us tonight. Everybody liked it. After the break, we'll talk about how scientists use DNA and stone tool artifacts to piece together the story of the first Americans. And playing us to the break, Shane Marler and Nikki Mottlemog. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato at the Orpheum Theater in Wichita, Kansas. Now, if you could have seen Wichita and the Great Plains around 20,000 years ago, well, it was a real ghost town. In fact, all of the Americas was. It was one of the last parts of the world to be populated by modern humans. One of the first migrant group was the Clovis. They lived here around 13,000 years ago. And you probably remember learning in your elementary school science class about the Bering Strait land bridge. Remember about that? That the first Americans migrated from Asia over that land bridge? Well, like a lot of things, it turns out the story of how the Americas was populated might be a little more complicated. So, who were these first Americans? How did they get here? And how do scientists piece together this mystery? My next guests are both anthropologists who study these questions, but they come at them from a different perspective, using different tools. Let me introduce them. Jennifer Raff is a genetic anthropologist. She is an assistant professor at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. Welcome to Science Friday. Yes. Frederick Soleil is an anthropologist who specializes in ancient stone tools, and he's an associate professor also at the University of Kansas. Welcome, Science Friday. Dr. Soleil, let's talk about the Clovis. We know the Clovis were spread out all around North America, right? But what do we know about how they lived, what their society was like? How do we know that?
Surprisingly, we know very little. The first Clovis site was excavated in 1930, 32, so for almost 100 years, and we know very little about their habitation structure, social structure. What we know is we know what they ate. We know that they hunt mammoth, among other things, but also smaller animals. We know that they made beautiful stone tools.
In fact, we have some. If they're going to eat those mammoths, they had to go hunting for them, right?
It would be a challenge to go after a mammoth, as you can imagine, without any weapon.
So, here's some. Describe these large stone tools. Look about a foot long.
The largest ones are actually probably symbolic. Those were not the ones used for hunting mammoths, but the small one, which is about 4 inches, 4 or 5 inches in length, that's the one that was used for killing mammoth. So they have one very particular feature that is a groove at the base on each side. There's a flake that was removed to kind of thin the point and make it easier to haft. And that's the signature of the Clovis people.
Because it really looks like they put a lot of work into that.
They were craftsmen of tremendous skill, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you tried to make some of these, reproduce these
yourself? It took me a few years to
a few years.
Practice.
Now, Jennifer, you approach it not from someone who's digging up the tools, right? But you approach it, the Clovis, the genome of the Clovis, right?
That's right.
What does it tell you about the lineage then of the Clovis?
So we only have one Clovis genome, and that is because there's really only one Clovis burial that we're aware of a human individual. And fortunately, I didn't do the work, but another lab was able to recover a genome from that individual, who is now known as the Anzig child. And what that genome tells us is really remarkable, that there were Native Americans, the ancestors of contemporary Native Americans look genetically similar. The Clovis peoples were the ancestors of all living Native Americans today. And that we can look, if you look at the complete genome, we can actually detect genetic structure in Native American populations that tell us something about how they peopled the continent. And it's really a remarkable find, and it really changed the way that we understand the discipline today.
So just to get that clear, they are the ancestors of Native Americans.
Absolutely, and this is not something that was surprising to any geneticist who works in the field, but there were a number of sort of alternative ideas about the ancestry of indigenous Americans, and the Clovis genome really put all of them to rest, I think.
And now we've heard news reports and research and finds that there were perhaps groups of people in the Americas even before the Clovis. What's your feeling about that?
So it's been really well established archaeologically and genetically that there were people here prior to the Clovis culture. But they, too, were the ancestors of indigenous Native Americans. So we see very irrefutable evidence that all Native Americans are descended from the earliest indigenous peoples of the Americas.
How would they have gotten here? Could they have gotten here by boat? Would they make some boats? Instead of going over the land bridge, they would come by boats, perhaps?
The current most accepted model is, and you'll find people who disagree about this, but the current most accepted model is that people actually moved into Beringia and lived there. It wasn't just a land bridge that people raced across to get to North America. They actually lived there in what we would call refugia, or small little pockets of productive areas of land where there were animals living and plants, and that people could live there and survive the glacial maximum, where it was very, very cold and inhospitable. And so people lived there for some period of time. Genetically, we see evidence that suggests that the time that they lived there may have varied between, let's say, 7,000-10,000 years. Some people estimate as much as 15,000 years. And they lived there until the pathways opened up, probably first along the West Coast, and then traveled down the West Coast as far as South America quite rapidly, and then peopled the continents across the land.
How hard is it to find these tools? How do you know where to look in the ground for these sort of things?
Well, I don't. That's the problem.
Let me go on to the next question. No, I mean, but you found them. You did. You weren't just lucky. You had to have there's a lot of geology to go through here.
Yes, we have to work with geologists. They point to the right age sediments. So we know where to look. It doesn't mean that we're going to find a site. Most sites that are that old are actually found by chance. It's somebody's digging. You have to understand that anything that is 13,000 years old is going to be buried very deeply. For it to be found, it has to be unearthed by some heavy equipment, or we have to have a lot of erosion. So in Kansas, western Kansas, there is a lot of erosion. So during the Dust Bowl, people found artifacts laying on the surface. But a lot of these have been picked up over the years, so they are getting very, very hard to find now.
Jennifer, I heard that you once tried to get genetic material from a brain that you found in a bog. How did that work out for you?
Well, I didn't find the brain. It was sent to the lab, and this was way back when I was a graduate student, and I was not successful at getting DNA from that brain.
Why? Because? Tell us get in the weeds on that a little
bit. Yeah, so DNA preservation is very tricky. You're really lucky in the lab if you get a 50% success rate. So you kind of have to be a special kind of crazy person to really keep working in this field. But
and you are that kind
of person.
Yeah, I
am, I'm afraid.
That's good.
But DNA preservation is dependent on not just the age of a sample, but also the deposition conditions. So if a sample is deposited in a very dry, cold environment like the Arctic. We like to work up in the Arctic because we get really good preservation up there. And there are some other situations where you'll get really nice DNA preservation. The type of bone or tissue that you sample from can determine the likelihood of preservation. So there's just a whole lot that goes into that. And you can't know, unfortunately, in advance whether or not you're going to get DNA successfully from something. You have to just try it, and that can be very frustrating sometimes.
Yeah, a brain that gets bogged down is not it. All right, it's the last one, I promise. There are the boos. Okay, I asked for them. Hey, it wouldn't be my show if I didn't come up with a few of these every week. Let's go to the audience right here.
How did the Clovis hunt?
Oh, how did the Clovis hunt? The mammal, the animals.
I mean, wouldn't you say it? You have to say it again.
These
we
kids
don't,
are asking the greatest
really
questions today. That's great.
You guys are asking hard questions. We know they hunt them with those Clovis points they're made. And we have a mammoth found in Arizona at the NACO site that had about 8 Clovis points found. And we think that that mammoth actually ran away. It survived and managed to run away. So the Clovis hunters never caught up with them. So we know that they were throwing spears into the mammoth and probably quite a few spears in order to kill it. But they must have still tracked the mammoth for hours, possibly for days, before they could butcher the animal. So how they hunt them, we don't really know if they hunt them in large groups or individually. One thing is sure, that mammoths are really, really big. So you have to run really fast if you miss.
So, you are highly motivated then, and that must imply also that if you want to increase your odds of killing a mammoth, you don't hunt singly, you go with a group of people, right? I mean...
Correct. What we know is that most people hunt communally. So if you hunt on your own, you're much better off hunting a turtle than a mammoth. So some of these groups, we're talking about groups of maybe a dozen, 2 to 3 dozen people. So they would come together and aggregate during the year, and then they would help each other. And, you know, when you have 30 people, it's a little bit easier to go after something big as a mammoth.
I wish we could give a mammoth an equal time here to defend themselves. But I'm Ira Plato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Let's go right here. Yes.
In the last decades or two, there's been so much information coming out based on genetics data and using it in all sorts of sciences. What do you think is the greatest application of genetics in archaeology has been discovered, and then what do you think is going to be the greatest discovery, or what would you like to see?
So I think the greatest thing that has happened in genetics recently has been really the ability to get complete genomes from ancient contexts. That has really revolutionized our discipline, because instead of looking at just one marker of ancestry that's inherited, say, just from your mother or just from your father, which is what we did before, we're able now to get complete genomes from ancient remains, and that can tell us about all of a person's ancestors. And that really helps us understand what a population, what the events that led to a population's history. Because population histories and evolution is actually archived in the genomes of the people who lived through those histories and their descendants. So that has been just absolutely transformational in our discipline. And in new techniques, improved techniques in the lab for getting DNA out of really tricky bones, that's been really, really helpful. I think that one of the major things that we have learned from these new types of evidence has been that you can't assume anything about human history. You can look at archaeological evidence, you can look at other types of evidence, but they don't necessarily tell you about what a population has done artifacts can, that you see moving around the landscape may tell you something about how culture is shared between populations or between groups, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people were moving around themselves and exchanging mates and having descendants. So we see examples of contact between different cultures through the exchange of artifacts and material goods without there actually being any kind of biological consequence to that. And then we also see the opposite in the archaeological, in the genetic record. We see complete population replacements happening with very little archaeological evidence of that. So you just can't make assumptions about human history and about human biological history without really going out and looking at the DNA itself.
Oh, thank you. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Jennifer Raff is a genetic anthropologist, assistant professor at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. Fred Soleil, also an anthropologist that specializes in ancient stone tools, also at the University of Kansas. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. That's about all the time we have. Our heartfelt thanks to Deborah Fraser, Sarah Jane Crespo, John Cyphers, Jordan Kirtley, Beth Golay, and all the wonderful folks at KMUW. Oh, and let's give one last round of applause to our amazing musical guests, Shane Marler and Nikki Muddlemog, who will play us off tonight. And to Diana Gordon, Barney Byard, Robert Lucky Morris, Joshua Gordon, Bailey Vaughn, Madeline Ghostland, and everyone here at the Orpheum Theater for making this wonderful evening possible, and to our production partners at the City University of New York. And we can't forget our Science Friday staff. Yeah, Charles Berquist, Rachel Batten, Daniel Dana, Brandon Echter, Ella Fetter, Jennifer Fennick, Sochi Garcia, Luke Raskin, Katie Heiler, Christopher Intagliata, Jen Kwok, Alexa Lim, Johanna Mayer, Annie Minoff, Annie Nero, Sushmita Patak, Daniel Peterschmidt, Christian Scotta, Christy Taylor, Lauren Young, Tony Zisa, and Ariel Zitch. Thank you all for coming. In Wichita, Kansas, I'm Ira Plato. Drive safely, everybody. Have a good night.
I know you're gone, but I'll carry on somehow. I still breathe and you're not around. If you change your mind sometimes and realize we were fine, I'll be waiting here for you. Maybe I'm just a fool. Maybe I'm just a fool. Maybe I'm just a fool for loving you. Maybe I'm just a fool. Maybe I'm just a fool. Maybe